All right, everybody, you know how much I love TrueCar because it's changing car buying forever. TrueCar helps car buyers get rid of the fear that they might overpay. Just in the first 6 months of this year, over 275,000 cars were sold by the TrueCar Certified Dealer Network, and TrueCar users save, get this, an average of $3,221 off manufacturer's suggested retail price. When you're ready to buy a car, just follow these three easy steps. First, go to TrueCar.com to find out what others paid for the car you want. Then, register to see upfront pricing information and lock in your savings. Third step, very simple. Just print out your savings certificate and take it to the TrueCar certified dealer for a better, hassle-free car buying experience. Some features not available in all states. To see how much you can save on the car you want, simply download the TrueCar mobile app or visit TrueCar.com today. That's TrueCar.com.
Warriors, come out to play. Warriors, come out to play.
One day, nothing would move without us allowing it to happen.
Hey, folks, welcome to the show. This week, I have my buddy Zane Lamprey on. I was on his show, The Zane Lamprey Show. He's a host. He's got had a series of shows, sort of travel drinking shows, really fun shows like Three Sheets, Drinking Made Easy, and his latest one is called Chug, coming out on the National Geographic Channel this week. And they're really cool. It's not just him getting hammered in bars, but the, you know, people just actually like teaching you stuff about how some drinks are made. It's a really, really, really fun show, and he's really knowledgeable and a cool guy, and we have some laughs, and I talk about how I passed out with my pants down. So for no other reason, you need to tune in for that. But check it out, and check me out doing stand-up. I am going to be this week at the Omaha Funny Bone. That is this Thursday through Saturday, November 20th to the 23rd, and then December 3rd through the 7th, I'm at the Columbus Funny Bone in Columbus, Ohio. December 11th to the 15th, I'm at the Denver Improv. And December 18th to the 21st at the DC Improv. So if you're in any of those cities, I just got done performing at the Foxwoods Casino. Had a great time, some great pictures on Facebook. You guys got to come out on the road. People have been coming out, we've been listening to the podcast, and I really appreciate it. And wherever I go, I tell my Paul McCartney story that I got Paul McCartney on my podcast and how. So keep spreading the word about the podcast. People, we're building followers, and I need you guys to be my army out there and tell the world about this this podcast and what we're doing and the kind of guests we're getting all across the board, really interesting people. So please check me out online, paulmercurio.com, Facebook and Twitter, Paul Mercurio. My tour dates are on Facebook page and on my website. And see you on the road.
The street suckers! Can you dig it?
Hello, podcast listeners. Welcome to the show this week. My friend, my buddy, I was on his show, Mr. Zane Lamprey. Nice to have you on the show, my friend. And
Paul, why are you yelling at everybody? I feel like you're yelling at people right now. They're nice enough to tune into your show, and you're just yelling at them.
I yell constantly. That's my thing.
I'm just excited. I'm just excited, damn it.
I'm out of my mind. I'm half drunk. So, you know, what are you going
to
do?
You know what? That makes me want to go to the fridge. I'm going to the fridge right now. I don't care what time it is. It doesn't matter to me.
I had a great time on the show when I was in L.A., by the way. That was really funny. You made me drink. Zane has a Zane Lamprey show, which is... Are you drinking it or are you spilling it all over the
place? No, I was that was me going to the fridge. You know what? There's choices. When you go into my fridge, Paul,
yes,
there are choices to be made. So it's not something easy... It's not an easy task. So there's a little bit of bottle knocking that happens.
And what are you thinking of going for? What are we looking at?
You know what I was sent is Carhartt beer.
The Carhartt the clothing people.
Yeah, exactly. It's Carhartt. It's called the Woodsman. It's barrel aged pale ale, which is made from New Holland Brewing Company. It just seems a little, I know, isn't that, how far removed is that from like Levi's making you beer?
I was going to say, what about Stanley Tools? Is Stanley Tools going to come out with a beer?
Or you know who makes a delicious beer is Jordache. It is fantastic. It's subtle. It's tight. It's really nice. It's really nice.
You drink it and you want to go to a club later and rave, right?
I don't know what you want to do. You want to jump in a hot tub time machine or something. It's nuts. It's nuts.
Well, I was on your show, The Zane Lamprey Show, which is your weekly podcast. I had a great time. And you have a show coming out on the National Geographic Channel, November 24th, called Chug, which is a new international drink and travel show that kind of follows you around the world, and which has kind of been your sort of stock and trade the last several years. And I'm fascinated that, you know, you were able to kind of – You started out doing, you know, shows as a host and projects for Comedy Central, VH1, Nickelodeon, stuff like that. You were the host of VH1's Motor Mouth. How did the sort of the drinking thing kind of come into play for you, for people who may not be aware of your...
It's a good story. I moved out to L.A. like in 1996 to like, after college, to be an actor or just whatever, figure something out, you know? They quickly found that there was this thing called hosting, which, mm-hmm. which of course there were always hosts growing up, but you never really considered that like a job. You know what I mean? Like, it's like you got actors and then hosts are sort of like the blue collars of, you know, and you just don't even consider it as a career path. You can go to acting. I went to college and got a degree in acting, but mm-hmm. they didn't cover hosting, you know, it should have been an entertainment degree, you know, where they taught you how to do all that kind of stuff. Because when you move out to LA, you don't know what your opportunities are going to be. So you should be open to all your options. So I went and auditioned for this thing. It was a show called You Should Open a Restaurant. And it's basically the idea of the show is that you, Paul, you're such a good chef that somebody nominates you to turn your house into a restaurant for the day. And they bring in hosts. They bring in chefs and, you know, sous chefs and wait staff and all this kind of stuff. And just like literally make it so your house is a restaurant. Mm-hmm. And so I went in to audition for the host part. And they're like, it was more of an interview than an audition. And they're just talking to me, what are you into? What do you do? And I was making them laugh and whatever. And they're like, oh my gosh, you are not right for this part. But, you know, and I'm like, oh, okay. They're like, but thanks for coming down. I'm like, yeah, sure. I only had to drive, you know, 2 hours in LA traffic to get here. But I thought you guys liked me. I thought, like, how am I not right? They're like, no, you don't understand. It's like, we're looking for a host or a hostess, like in the restaurant, like someone to seat people.
Oh my God.
Yeah. You're not anchoring this show. You're literally standing there and not talking and telling someone where to go sit, you know? And so I'm like, oh, okay. That
did you
sense.
Did you immediately, like most desperate actors in New York, I know you weren't like, well, I can do that. And then you start going into that mode.
I was tempted. I mean, you go through all these periods. And again, I mean, that was like 10 years ago. Yeah. And so, you know, there's always something cooking, but you're like, a bird in the hand, right? For an actor, especially when you're living hand to mouth, which is what I was doing. I was like, I'm overqualified. I'll see you later, you know. So I leave. The production company was based out of Seattle. And so they flew in to do auditions, and they just got a hotel room right near LAX. And so
but here's the problem I have with this. You have to fly into LA to audition people to stand there in either a black dress or a tuxedo or whatever.
Well,
and go,
it's true. But there were other roles as well. But yeah, that's interesting. I don't know what other things they were filling.
Yeah.
But so I left and I walked down the hall and then this guy who I thought at the time was a camera guy, come to find out he's the owner of the company. It's a big company. They do Mick Dodge, and they did Hoarders. And they did Flip This House and Sell This House. They do a lot of shows. And he's like, hey, Zane,
talking about this show like last week called Three Sheets, where the host would travel around the world and drink, and we thought, think you'd be great for it. Is that something you'd be interested in? And I'm like, yeah, of course.
That sounds terrible.
I can't. I'm Muslim. Thank you. Bye-bye. but as an actor, I'll do it anyway.
Right.
And so I'll do it anyway. I'll just pretend to drink.
So, exactly.
So because they were actually not from LA and from somewhere else in this wonderful country, they when they said, I'll call you next week, they actually called me next week.
Did they really?
Yeah, it's a strange practice. I guess that's what they do outside of New York and LA.
Yes, yes, yes. They also celebrate their friends' birthdays and.
If they say they're going to be someplace, they actually show up. You know, it's like throwing a party in LA. We're actually having the premiere party. National Geographic is throwing the premiere party for Chug on Wednesday. And the space holds 150, so they're inviting 400. And that's just LA. It's the way it goes. But right. if you did it in Seattle, you invite 400 and you're going to have 99 people.
Probably have 800 because people start bringing their friends and there's mothers and sisters and everything else. In LA, it's going to be 400 is going to get you 100. And then they're going to be 50 guest fillers, seat fillers that they're going to hire for the other 50.
that's probably true. So I went and started doing this show called Three Sheets. I went up and Three Sheets was traveling around the world drinking. Mm. And so I went up to Seattle to shoot the pilot at a Polish social club. And I wasn't sure if they wanted me to be funny, to know my shit, or if they just wanted someone who could drink a lot. So I did all those things. Like I prepared jokes. I prepared, I knew the history of Poland and drinking history. I had my drinking games on.
You joined the polka band and played polka.
Oh dude, this play. Yeah. Yes. 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 I joined a polka band for a month just to get in my character. and I get up there and this place is like, most of the people there just spoke Polish, which I don't understand how people can do that. Can live in the U.S. and not speak the. Maybe they're visiting, but anyway. So it was just like it was a very immersive experience, and I drank a lot, I knew a lot, and apparently I was pretty funny. And it got really messy, but at the end they put it together. The network loved it, and then they said, "All right, let's go do." I think it was 8 episodes or something like that. Mm-hmm. And the channel was called Mojo. Actually, it was called.
Yeah, I remember that. Now, in the pilot, you just stayed in that bar and you were just bringing characters on camera and talking about the booze and
because it was a sizzle. It was a sizzle, so that means it was in like 5 to 7 minutes long or something like that.
Right.
And I went in there and I sat at the bar and talked to the guy about beer, and then I went into the kitchen and was eating tripe, which I thought was a fish. I didn't know.
My father used to like tripe. It's cow intestines, and if you touch the bowl, it wiggles. It's like really, it's like a delicacy, especially among the Italians and other ethnicities. But it was horrible.
Yeah, delicacy means gross.
Right, exactly.
Anywhere you go, that's literally that's the translation.
When you say delicacy, it's like I'm trying to sound sophisticated to talk about something that I wouldn't put in my ass.
That's exactly right.
And literally, you looked at it and go, I remember looking at that and going, I would not shove that in the ass of a prisoner.
I looked at it and I said, I don't know what you guys want me to do with that, but I'm not putting that in my ass.
And they said, well, then you're not Polish. And
you can eat it. I'll eat it, but I'm not putting that in my ass.
Exactly. My ass has standards, goddammit.
Yes, my mouth does not. I'll put anything in my mouth once. That didn't come out right.
True. I was on his show. The amount of stuff that this guy put in his mouth, it was shocking, I'll tell you, shocking.
During this whole time, I'm just continuing to drink. And then I sit down at a table of young people, in their 20s, and they have a bottle of vodka. And like a tradition is, when you start a bottle, you finish it. And so that happened. And then I was all ready to leave. And there was this guy who was supposed to have come a lot earlier. And he made what was referred to as bathtub vodka.
Yeah. And the more I've learned, I want to tell, remind me to tell another story about moonshine after this one.
Okay. So I
enjoy telling this story because most of the time it kind of goes into the sort of the evolution of how I got to be on Chug. I like telling a story that I really haven't told a lot, but like, I met this Polish social club, and I was waiting for this guy. I was all set, and then this guy shows up, and he's got a mustache, so you know he means business. And it wasn't November, and he shows up with like these little bottles, like, you know, something you would have gotten in college to smuggle into the football game, you know, that would kind of fits in your pants basically. And he brought in like a few of those, and they had painter's tape keeping them shut. And they were like cinnamon and like all these different ones. And they were just like, it was so strong.
Yeah.
And so I started drinking with this guy, and he kept wanting to do shots. And he was hammered, you know, when he got there. And then he was like, I like you. He didn't sound like Borat, but that's what I'm going with. He's like, I like you. He's like, I like you. You will come to my cabin on Christmas.
Cabin.
I'm like, yeah. You had me a cabin.
Right. And by cabin, I'm assuming it's not sort of this palatial Aspen, Colorado sort of woodsy mansion. We're probably talking an outhouse with windows.
It was somewhere near Seattle, some ski place.
Right.
Where he is a volunteer or hired ski patrol. So he, you know, has like the red vest or whatever it is. And he skis around saving people, probably with bathtub vodka in a barrel around his neck. But, right, exactly.
But he's like a human Saint Bernard.
Yeah, exactly. He just grows out the beard. He's not just a mustache guy. And so he was like, and he's bragging to me about how he's, you know, he's ski patrol. And he's like, you come for Christmas. And I'm like, well, you know, I have family, you know, which might take some sort of priority over going to some weird guy's cabin in the woods in Washington State on, you know, the biggest holiday of the year. But okay, you know, whatever. And we were kind of done, and he wouldn't let me leave until I promised, you come, I ski patrol. That's how he kept saying, you come, Christmas, I'm ski patrol. Because ski patrol was like, oh, let me work on your foot. I'm a doctor. You know, right. Like, come to my cabin. I'm ski patrol. And so he wouldn't leave me alone. I had to actually like do this thing where I sort of talked into, I pulled my shirt out to talk into my lav mic, which was taped, you know, inside my shirt. Mm. And I said, I need some help here. So I'm going to go to the bathroom, and then I want to have somebody sitting outside in a getaway car, because, you know, we were done. I mean, we had been at that place for 5 hours. Everyone was done. Before the guy even showed up, they said, we got enough for the show. And so I get up to go to the bathroom. He's like, I go too. I'm like, oh my Lord. And then I went, and then he's peeing next to me, and I leave. I'm like, oh, I think I have to go to the other one, you know, number two. And he's like, oh, okay. And I went in there. And then, you know, and like waiting for him to like walk away.
Wait, let me guess. He starts making vodka in the sink.
I will ferment your poop. We're best friends.
This will be the best vodka ever.
Yes. We will make people drink it. So we will. Yeah, oh, you know what? It could have been what we were drinking in the mountains. Who knows? But I run out. There's one of the PAs, a sober PA, sitting in her car. I jump in. She pulls away. And as she stops leaving the park, it's dark and it's rainy. And as she's leaving the parking lot, figure that, Seattle, dark and rainy. and someone opens my door, and he's like, "You promised ski patrol." I go, "Yes."
Jesus.
And I go, "Floor it." And she like took off, the door closed, and then that was it. And you know what? Christmas at his cabin was actually pretty nice.
You went?
Pretty nice. No, I did not go.
Oh my God, I'm just having awesome. Did you? You did. You just don't want to admit it. You
yes, exactly.
You spooned by the fire.
Yes.
I know.
Yes. On. Sorry, Mom. I have other plans.
How do you make bathtub vodka, by the way? Like, I would imagine that part of this sort of trajectory you've been on, you probably knew about as much as the average person did about alcohol, basically how to consume it. But I assume you've learned a lot over the years about how to.
You're right. You're me.
So how do you make bathtub vodka?
Well, so that brings me into my second story, which will sort of tie the whole thing together. And yes, sure. When I started doing the show, I was average. I was like as average as you can be. And average as far as knowledge about drinking is concerned, or what we are drinking, is extremely limited. Mm-hmm. I didn't know the difference between whiskey and vodka besides the color. I didn't know the difference between fermentation and distillation. I just didn't get the whole processes of the whole thing. Now it's been 10 years and I actually have my own rum company. So like I've learned, I've written a book on it, whatever. So like I now know enough so that to be able to dumb it down for the viewers. Because, and again, it's not dumbing it down, but it's making it sort of digestible in small bites, because no one wants to hear about like, oh, you know, the mash tun, the lager tun, the fermentation, you know, all that kind of stuff. So we're still getting our heads around the
various beer commercials where the guy with the incredibly long beard has his hands in a bunch of hops and the hops are falling through his fingers. That's kind of the extent of our,
that now is imagery that you wouldn't have had 10 years ago. Like the craft beer movement, the craft cocktail movement, which everyone listening is familiar with.
Right.
10 years ago, you were not. You can, you know, there's maybe 1% of the people that knew.
So maybe you've got a great idea for a business and want to start selling your products or services online. Maybe you're an established business owner looking for new customers, or maybe you're interested in starting a personal website. No matter who you are, GoDaddy wants to help you succeed online. Right now, GoDaddy is offering a .com domain for just, get this, $1.49. You know, you can't get $1.49 for $1.49. That's a bargain, people. It's go time. Start your website today. Visit GoDaddy.com and enter promo code Paul149. That's Paul149, all one word, to get your $1.49.com. Some limitations apply. See website for details.
Now, what opened that boom?
What do you think sort of ushered that in?
You tell me.
Yeah.
It was me, Paul.
Oh, absolutely. Wait, what was
it? It was me.
It was you in a cabin with vodka.
Me in a cabin with vodka.
Right.
It was slowly happening. You know, there's the forefathers. There's like
Sam Adams.
There's Cook, and then there's this guy Charlie Finkel, who was the first guy to like bring in beer, like international beer other than lagers. And you know, besides Guinness, it was Guinness and lagers. That's really all we ever right. drank. Mm-hmm. And now the ales are starting to come in, and it's people, you know, wine just gets to be too much. It's too heady. Yeah. It's all the same color. It all pretty much tastes the same. Yeah. The prices are so arbitrary. I mean, you can have, it's an amazing story. There's this group, and they went into who was it? Bobby Flay's restaurant, mm-hmm. one of his high end places, and it was a big group, like 8 or 10 people, mm-hmm. and they were drinking wine or whatever, and they needed another bottle of wine, and so one of the guys at the table is like, we'll get another bottle. Oh, just recommend something. What do you have that's, you know, like, you know, a red or whatever? She's like, oh, we have this such and such, just this and that. He's like, oh, okay. What, how much is that? She's like, $37.50. He's like, yeah, we'll take it. Go for it. So they, you know, they're drinking it, whatever. And then the bill comes and their bill is over $4,000. And they're like, what the hell's going on? And they look at it, and yes, it is $37.50. It's $3,750.
Oh, Jesus. Oh my God.
And this is a true, I promise you, this is a true story. This was in the paper. This happened last week. And so they basically, the restaurant made them pay and then fight it later, and then decided that, that they were not, the restaurant was not in the wrong. They have video of them ordering it, but they don't have the audio of them ordering it. And the guy's like, why would I, like, we weren't drunk. Why would I order something that was $3,700? And if that's the case, you should really make sure, if it's a $4,000 bottle of wine, you should probably just repeat it back and forth. Bat it around, you know, pass it around the table.
It's like at a bar when you tip the bartender and they ring the bell. You should definitely have a bell that goes, we got a $4,000 bottle here.
Look, I don't know where you come from, but where I come from, that thing comes out with sparklers. You know what I mean? And exactly. You can afford it. and that is the direction that wine has gone, and that's where wine is and has been for a long time.
But you know what? I got friends who are wine snob, and I refuse to buy crazy expensive wine. I'll show up with like a $15 bottle of wine. I don't tell them how much it is, and they're like, "Oh my god, this is fabulous! This is like the blah blah blah. That's $120." And I'm like, "Yeah, I guess it is."
Put a fake price tag on it. People don't know.
Yeah.
People don't know. And if you do a blind taste test, do a blind taste test and have somebody who's a freaking expert, you know, and go out there and get, you know, don't get shit wine, you know, don't get $2 Chuck, but go out and get a $15 bottle, a 30, and then get a 70. Like, you don't have to go higher. I mean, 70, God, that's a lot of money, you know?
Yeah.
And so like that's as high as you need to go, and do a taste test and let them all breathe the same amount of time. Good luck. Good luck picking it out. And that's why beer works. Now, the beer craft beer movement was pushed by the food movement, which we know more, we care more about what it is that we're eating. And that, you know, we give credit to the Food Network and other places for making that happen. That's obviously not just them.
Yeah.
And so now we start caring about beer, and then we want to know more about it. Like, and maybe we can pair it and we can, you know, do these different things. And people, when you go someplace now, especially, you can go into a bar in Kansas City or Boise or you know, anywhere, and you can get a local beer. And you didn't used to be able to do that except for in Milwaukee and St. Louis, Missouri. You know, so that's now right. Something you can do anywhere.
Right.
And that's kind of like, you know, now that's actually moving into spirits, and then it's also moving into craft cocktails where people can, you go in and you can. Quite often have a local spirit, or you can have something made with local ingredients. You can have something seasonal. You can have something fresh. And so there is, you know, there's a lot happening, which is great. Because that gives me a lot of things to talk about.
Yeah. I was just in Austin, Texas, and every bar I was in, they were pushing Tito's vodka on me, which I guess is a Texas.
Well, Tito's vodka is that's big business. I had him on the show. That guy is worth hundreds of millions of dollars right now. And you know, he started off. I know his story. I mean, he started off small. He was craft. Mm-hmm. You know, craft in that he literally just made every batch by hand. And now he's in a much bigger facility, pushing out a lot. I mean, most bars have it. You know what I mean?
That's a big deal. But vodka is another one that falls into that wine category for me. You put 7 vodkas down, not flavored, just let's straight up. Like,
yeah.
Okay. I know, like, pop off, like when we were in high school, we would drink and fucking drive and all this crazy shit. And like, we get pop off vodka for like $6 and it was horrible. That you could tell the difference between that and Grey Goose. But when you start to get to, like, for me, Absolute, Kettle One, Grey Goose, Tito's, it's like, I don't have the palate to know, oh, it's more heavy in the potato. It's a blah, blah, blah. I don't know.
You're not drinking. Like, I've gone to like Poland and sat down with the owner of Chopin and Belvedere vodka. And like, and when I'm sitting with him and he's talking about, you know, I was sitting by a lake in the summer and we were drinking vodka that was room temperature. And he was telling me about like what goes into it and all that kind of stuff. And like in that instance, I could taste the rye, I could taste the wheat, I could taste all that kind of stuff. But that was because I was there with the guy who made it, you know, and that's often how it is. Mm. But I've never since had Chopin warm, you know, next to a lake, you know, I'm usually, it's cold, it's in a glass and it's mixed with something.
Right.
That's, even if it's just olives.
Exactly. And just so everybody knows, it was a lake of vodka. So you had to, actually go swimming in the lake with the vodka.
It's Poland. It's Poland. They have a lot of vodka.
But
here's the story about the moonshine thing.
Mm-hmm.
So I went to this guy who was a home brewer, decided to be, he wanted to be a home distiller, and he was a fourth generation moonshiner. That's what he called himself, but he was one generation removed, meaning his dad didn't do it. So when he went off to start distilling, he didn't have anyone to teach him. No, that's not really a fourth generation distiller. That's not really how that works. You know, you need to have the craft handed down from you to learn it. You can't just, you know what I mean? You can't just be off on your own and invent it. Your fourth generation would normally mean you have four generations of knowledge in you. So what this guy was doing was he had a beer club, home brewing. When they would ruin a batch, you can still salvage the alcohol that's in that, because beer, it's, you know, let's call it roughly 6%. So what you're doing when you're distilling it is you're heating it less than the temperature of boiling, and because alcohol evaporates at a lower temperature than water. Mm-hmm. And so you have a flame underneath it, the alcohol evaporates, everything else stays, it rises up, it condenses, meaning it turns into a liquid from a gas. And it drips down, it drip, 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 and then you can fill this bucket with your moonshine. That's like the simplified version of it, and that's how moonshine is made. Mm-hmm. The important thing to know when doing this process is that there's something called heads, tails, and hearts. Well, technically heads, hearts, and tails. And what that is when you start to make distill this, the first stuff that comes off are these very bad things. These they're not only off tasting, but they're bad for you. It's not just alcohol that's coming off of that. Mm-hmm. And so you need, that's called the heads. You mm-hmm. fill that in a bucket, and then as soon as the head portion is done, you throw that bucket away. Mm-hmm. Then you have the hearts. And the hearts is what we drink. Mm-hmm. We drink the hearts of alcohol. Mm-hmm. And then at some point at the end, when it starts to, you know, get hotter, then you're evaporating other, you know, more bad ingredients, and those are the tails. You throw that away as well. Mm-hmm. So you only drink the hearts. Mm-hmm. Where people get into trouble, like in Russia and other places, when people are making alcohol that's killing people, is that when these idiots don't know the difference between, you know, they don't know the proper temperatures and procedure, and especially when to separate and how to separate the heads, the hearts, and the tails. Mm-hmm. So I went and I was drinking with this guy who had a moonshine set up, and he takes a moonshine, and then he takes a piece of oak and he puts it in the fire until it gets charred, and then he mm-hmm. drops it into a jar with the moonshine, and it basically flash ages the moonshine, and it gets the color and some of the flavor of whiskey. And whiskey, you know, normally it takes several years to get, you know, to right. get all the color and everything. But since they just drop a giant log into a gallon of you know, it's called right. It's called Georgia char. It's basically moonshine that has put charred wood in it. Right. And I was drinking it, and I'm like, oh man. And it burned. It burned bad. Mm. And I'm like, man, I was watching you do this. Like how do you know how to separate, you know, when to separate the heads and the tails? And his response is, it's amazing. So if anyone listening can actually digest what I just sort of spewed out there. Spewed? Can I say spew? Can I say spew on your show?
Jizz,
spew, what I just jizzed out there. It was, I said, so when do you separate the heads and the tails? His response was, what are heads and tails?
Oh, Jesus.
that's
when you immediately,
oh my God.
You immediately go blind. I'm blind.
I had... Literally, it kind of ate away at my esophagus. So I had esophageal reflux disorder for about a year after that, like this burning, you know, and like in my throat, and it was and because of that horrible stuff. So it's interesting, like, you know, home brew is pretty safe. When you brew, low temperatures. It's a slow process. It's fermentation. It had, you know, the yeast at some point dies. So you can't really naturally brew something that's more than like,
And you're not talking about an alcohol percentage of 90 or 95%. You're talking about 7-8% at best. You're talking at,
Exactly. You're talking, 10%. If, you know, if the person knows what they're doing, they can get to that point. So, like homebrew is generally safe, not always delicious, but usually is.
I think it also serves a bigger market. I mean, you're sort of tapping into, you start tapping into the wine and high-end wine and vodka markets, for example. You're looking at a higher end of society, a sort of a more narrow niche, if you will, where, you know, your beers, you can sort of, you have a broad spectrum of people who can afford that product. So I would imagine that it's much more popular for that reason as well.
They have now this class of beer that we've always had. We just didn't have a name for it. And it's called a session beer. So it's something you can sit down and you know, drink a few and not, you know, lose your faculties over the course of, you know, whatever. Like if you drink, here's an interesting fact. So, if you, the higher something is in alcohol, the quicker it gets to your bloodstream. So while, you know, a pint of beer, a glass of wine and a shot of whiskey all have the exact same, you know, generally speaking, have the same amount of alcohol in them. The shot will get to your blood faster than the beer, even if you chug the whole thing, because it's because of the way that it's diluted. And so, like, doing
because it's because it's more heavily concentrated now as alcohol, right?
It absorbs into your bloodstream a lot quicker and more of it. Like, you know, you'll pee out some of the alcohol as well.
No, I'm with you. If I want to get fucked up, I start drinking Jack.
that's my point.
I do. I just do shots because also I'm not a big guy. I got friends that like will just drink beer, get hammered on beer. I get so bloated and like I can't. So I just, and I've had, you know, although I remember when I was 17, I had the SATs the next morning and I decided it was toward the end of the year. I was a senior in high school. I'm like, yeah, my friend has a party and has a keg, and I drank 22, like 16 ounce, you know, those silo cups, whatever those red plastic. I drank 16 of those, like 140 pounds soaking wet. I got so fucked up, and this has been a pattern of mine over the years. I get really fucked up when I sell. Like I passed the bar exam, the same thing happened. Buddy of mine, I get so fucked up. I go into the bathroom. And in the middle of going to the bathroom, I decide, oh, I got to sit down for a minute. I'm getting dizzy. And I sit on the toilet seat and then I pass out in the bathroom with my pants down around my ankles. So now this happened in high school. So and this is not an anonymous event because what happens is because I'm a fucking idiot, you know, you lock the door like you do in a bathroom. So now nobody can get into the bathroom. So the whole party knows that somebody's fucking locked themselves in the bathroom and it's me. So then they have to break into the bathroom. And my friend in high school was Paul DeLeAngeli, takes a face cloth, takes my, you know, my junk, shoves it into my underwear, dresses me up. They bring me outside. They throw me in a lounge chair. It starts raining and they leave me in the lounge chair, fucking passed out, laughing their asses off at me. Fast forward like 10 years. I passed the bar exam in New York City at a buddy. This was in November. He has a creative black tie party where you wear a tuxedo with something creative, like a crazy bow tie or whatever. I get fucked up. I go to the bathroom. Same thing. I lock the door. I go to the bathroom and then I sit down for a minute and I pass out in the bathroom and they couldn't fucking get me out. So my buddy, Pete Sherlock, goes, I know what to do. He's an engineer. First, they're going to try to climb on the roof and go through the skylight, but there was snow on the skylight, and this is in Manhattan. They're like, you're going to fall off and end up on, like, 2nd Avenue.
Deck. Yeah.
So my buddy Pete takes a running start 30 feet back and punches a hole through the door. It was one of those hollow doors.
Yeah.
He just punches a hole through the door and unlocks the door, and they drag me out. And usually it's hard liquor that gets me. Like I just
Are there photos? I need some sort of I need to see these. I mean the imagery. I have the imagery all set anyway. But
we were talking about wine. We used to drive around in my mother's Oldsmobile in Providence, Rhode Island, and we'd get booze and we'd go play frisbee at one of the colleges in the parking lot, and then drive around and have races drunk with pot in the car. And then one day we decided to skip class in the middle of the day, and we got a loaf of bread, a hunk of provolone cheese, and a giant jug of this cheap, low-end Italian wine called Crebari, warm, and we were driving around at 16 in my mother's car drinking warm rind out of a giant jar. It was the most disgusting fucking thing, but it didn't matter. Like, you were just you were doing something you weren't supposed to do with alcohol. That's all that mattered, you know?
Did you say that you went and partied the night before the SATs?
Oh yeah. And my friends brought me home hammered, one under each arm, and they rang the bell, and they literally, it was like out of scene, and they ran to the car and drove away. And my father was a beer drinker, basically Narragansett beer, because we grew up in Rhode Island, which is a Narragansett brewery named after Narragansett. Now that was rebought recently and opened again, and they had the cool cases of beer. I remember bringing them down into the basement, and the cases were that really thick cardboard, and the lid opened in the center. They were flaps that opened, and they were reusable thick corrugated cardboard cases. So then you'd give them back to the company, and then they'd refill them.
I know exactly what you're talking about. Yep.
It's like old school. Like, I actually saw one in like a vintage shop, like somebody was selling it as a, like an artifact. It was like, I'm serious. It was like they were selling, you know, like if anything's old, people figure out a way to, you know, sell it as a thing. So anyway, long story short, they ring the doorbell. My father shows up and I'm fucking hammered. Oh, and by the way, like I had white painter's pants on and a white t-shirt, like puke fucking all over it. Right. I was a mess. And he goes, what have you been doing? You've been drinking? I go, yeah. He goes, oh my God, you're a mess. He goes, how many did you have? He goes, what'd you have? I go, beer. He goes, how many? And I remember having the presence of mind, even that drunk, of going, I said three or four. He goes, three or four? He goes, I remember I had 16-ounce glasses. He goes, three or four? He goes, glasses or bottles? And I remember having the presence of mind and going, if I say glasses, he's not going to believe it. But if I say bottles, he'll believe it. So I went, bottles. And he went, Jesus Christ, you had four bottles of beer? Get in here. I was like, woo, I dodged a bullet. I had dry heaves all night. And then he made me dry toast in the morning. And he made me go take the SAT. Fucking so hungover. The first time I was ever hungover in my life. And I got through 30 questions and I started throwing up in the bathroom again.
Oh,
and then I just walked out. I couldn't finish the SAT.
Oh, okay. Damn.
So
basically you got a 30 on your SATs.
Yeah, I got a lot of credit for getting my name right.
That's awesome.
Do you find when you're sort of doing these shows now that, you know, you got a lot going on. You're sort of you're trying to convey information about what you're drinking and where you are, and I guess people get to see the town or the city or the country you're in. But like, do you just find like you're drinking something that you just can't get down, but you got to, is it the macho guy and you've got to like, you know, kind of smile and grin and bear through it, or do you just sit there and go, fuck, this is horrible, I can't, like, how do you deal with those
things? Well, I mean, there's two answers to that. One is, you know, if people are thinking about, okay, I'm going off and I'm drinking and this is my job, right? So like I've definitely, like, you know, probably last weekend, whatever, you go on a Thursday, you go on a Friday, you go on a Saturday, you got football, you go out on a Sunday, a Monday, you're like, yeah, you know what? I kind of need a break. You know, I'm feeling pretty run down. Whatever.
Right.
See, when we're shooting, we go and we shoot, we drink. We have to, I mean, I have to every day, because time is money. You got a whole crew that's paid. You can't just be like, oh, let's take a day off. You're not going to pay people to take a day off.
Yeah.
And, you know, sometimes there's a travel day, but a lot of times travel days are also shoot days, you know, you travel and you'll land, you don't have to shoot real quick. So, you know, it's one of those things where, you know, it's funny. I'm not always jonesing for a drink, but once you have a drink, you're fine. You know what I mean? Then you'll take another
How do you pace it? Because that was an issue for David Talon, why he ultimately had to stop doing Insomniacs, because while that wasn't per se a drinking show and designed initially to be that, it was more like follow Dave around the country as he goes on tour and learn about the city. It really became more of like a drinking show, but not like the kind yours are, where you're like actually educating people about, you know, stuff. Like, it just was like, hey, we're in the bar now. And then he'd have to fucking drink and do these shots at these people, and he goes, I was going to develop a fucking problem, and it just took its toll. And but does it get that?
It's funny,
because you're not partying with people,
I think it's different. just different DNA or something. I don't know, because yeah. I got a bunch of buddies that once they start, they go nuts and they're gone. You know, like my buddy Steve McKenna. That's just he comes on the show. He's my buddy, and you can always count on him doing, you know, drinking and going nuts. Me, it's like, I mean, I have a few, and I feel like I become mm-hmm. I loosen up. I have more fun. I think I'm, you know, I think I become a little bit more funny. But if I kept going, then I would start to slur, and I wouldn't be as funny as I think I am, and you know that kind of stuff. So I don't know. I very rarely go past that point. I've always said, like, I maintain a 2.5 beer buzz. Like I kind of ride that wave, you know, steady. Yeah. It's funny that you say talk about that Dave Attell stuff, because I've sort of had this conversation with him and other people. Like people, when I started doing Three Sheets, people like, oh, so you're basically doing, you know, the same show as Dave Attell. And so many people have said, oh, it's, you know, it's the same thing as Insomniac. And I was like,
no, I wasn't suggesting that at all.
No, I know, but isn't it? So, I mean, you're someone that knows both shows, I assume. Like it's just, he's drinking and he's going off and learning about night culture. And I'm going off and drinking and learning about how drinks are made.
Yeah.
It's, you know, it's just, I guess because like, were we the first people to like actually drink on TV?
That's why I was very careful in saying that your shows are very different. Dave's show was conceived to be about Dave being on tour. They get a shot of him in the club, and then he's going around town, and then he goes like, this is where they make the milk. This is a big milk city. This is the cow country. Yeah. And then eventually, the bar aspect was one part of it, but became a bigger part of it over time. Your stuff is very different because you're, like I said, you're educating people about drinks and, you know, the history of drinks and everything else. And it's a completely different show. But the issue of part of what you have to do and what Dave was doing was drinking as part of the show.
Right.
To me, that was the only parallel of like,
I realize that. But right. I'm saying it's just funny when people come up to me and say that. I know that you weren't saying that, but I'm saying when people sometimes, you know, not too much anymore. But I was always like, really? I mean, like, I don't care. Like, they can make any, you know, correlation.
But those are people that don't understand. But those are people that don't understand the distinction between the shows. I mean, you know what I mean?
Right,
like
right.
That was not Dave's show. That was never designed to be Dave's show. But I mean, in your shows have a through line. I mean, between in my mind, from, you know, sort of. You know, you had Three Sheets and then you went to Drinking Made Easy and now you're doing Chug. And I mean, as you're going through iterations of this idea, like how's it evolved? How did Three Sheets evolve into Drinking Made Easy and Drinking Made Easy into Chug? And is Chug sort of the one that's coming out on November 24th, the sort of the synthesis of everything you've done up to that?
Yeah. Point? I mean, look, it is. It really is. If you defined it in a way, it kind of is a reality show. You know what I mean? Like, so Three Sheets it's just the funniness of it is it started on a channel called NHD. They changed their name to Mojo HD.
Mm-hmm.
They shut down. Then Fine Living Network bought it. They shut down. Then Travel Channel bought it. And then Spike bought it from them. So like it was airing through all these things. And so in Three Sheets, I was traveling around the world, drinking, learning about drinks and how different cities in every episode. I think I did like 52 of them. Mm-hmm. And I was kind of like, I was a regular guy. And if you watch them season 1 through 3, I think you can sort of see me, you know, me becoming more educated on what it is that I'm talking about. You know, before people were talking about fermentation, I just glazed over it because I didn't understand it and I didn't want to talk about it. And quite frankly, I didn't think that was what people at home cared about anyway. You know, they just wanted broad strokes, funny, entertaining, you know, this and that. So when by the time it landed on Spike, my contract was over, my like non-compete. So I called up Mark Cuban, who I knew was a fan of Three Sheets, and said, hey, let's make a show for HDNet, his network, mm-hmm. called Drinking Made Easy. I'll travel around the country and learn about drinking in the U.S. And he's like, all right, done. So we did 61 episodes for him over the course of 3 years. And then his channel turned into a music channel.
Right.
And then when that happened, I went around town in LA to all the different networks pitching a show called Chug, where I would travel around by train. And I would get off at different stops and then learn about drinking. So I'd like go to like, you know, France, for example, and I'd hop on a train and I go, you know, in Paris and I'd take a train to Champagne and then I'd take a train to Bordeaux and I would sort of travel around and learn. Mm-hmm. And then train would be my mode of transportation. Mm. And they were like, yeah, we don't know if we really want a drinking show. And so everyone passed on it. Mm-hmm. And so I then was talking to my mom and, you know, how are things going? Just my weekly call with my mom, whatever. And she's like, oh, you know, whatever. I told her about Chug and she's like, oh man, you should try kickstarting it. Mm. I go, mom, that's not, she's like, no, Veronica Mars is doing it and they're doing really well. I'm like, yeah, well, you know what, mom, that's just not how it works. Why don't you, you know, she's in Syracuse. I said, why don't you go and I'm sure you need to shovel your sidewalk. you go do that. And I'm going to do the big boy stuff out here, you know, like whatever. Ah. And then it's funny. I tell that story and I hope people don't think I was actually like a dick to my mom. I mean, like that's just.
No. Cause I grew up in Rhode Island and I get the same thing. Like I get, well, when, you did that show and that pilot and when are you going to get your own TV show? Why don't they put you on now? And I'm like, you know right. what? And then I get like, yeah, I'll just call up Les Moonves of CBS and say, okay, I'm ready. Where's my studio?
Oh, like, yeah, do that. You should do that.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah,
there's a charming naivete about that, which I totally get. Like, it's the same thing with my family.
That's
but
so
they
funny
write
that,
some,
yeah, yeah.
But sometimes, because they're not in it the way we are, like immersed in it,
yep.
they have a better advice or more objective advice that actually common sense, like good old... just logic sense that
works. Go make your own show. You know, it's like, and I've gotten that right when I've gone back to Syracuse for holidays and stuff. And they're like, oh, why don't you just go make your own show and sell it to the networks? I'm like, that's because that doesn't make any sense. That's not how you do it. You know, I can't, whatever. And so, anyway, so my mom said, go check out Kickstarter. I'm like, yeah, whatever. And I hung up and I go check out Kickstarter. I'm like, my jaw dropped. I'm like, are you kidding me? Like their goal was to turn Veronica Mars. I'm sure most people know the story by this point, but to take this show that had been canceled five or six years ago, turn it into a movie, bring everybody back. Mm-hmm. They wanted to raise $2 million. They by their third day they raised $4 million. Mm. In their first day they raised all of it. You know, and so I was like, holy cow! I have a similar sort of situation. So. I sent an email to my, it was late at night. I sent an email to my staff here at work and at the office. And I said, hey guys, I don't care what projects I have you on, drop it. We're doing Kickstarter. We start tomorrow. And then it launches in 2 weeks, figure it out, you know? Mm-hmm. And so the Kickstarter process is a long, you know, mm-hmm. it's not just like, oh, if you put a few pictures and make a video, it's a pretty detailed process of figuring out what you're giving as rewards, how much money you'll end up with, what's your, you know, I can't post on Facebook every day. Hey, go to my Kickstarter, go to my Kickstarter, go to my Kickstarter. You know, you need to figure out like how to talk about it without directly talking about it. And it was a long process. And so at the end, we were successful. We had 3 days left and we were trying to raise $500,000 to make 6 episodes. And with 3 days left, we were $180,000 short. And somehow everyone just most of the people were just a very last minute, last 3 days. And it all happened just boom in the last 3 days.
Wow.
And then we went up and shot it and made instead of half hours. I believe in under promising and over delivering. I try to do that whenever I can. And so I promised people the half hour episode and then I delivered them an hour episode. With extra stuff and, you know, behind the scenes thing and all that kind of stuff. And to, you know, because it was, you know, people took a chance on me and I wanted to show them that they were right by doing that. And so when we were done with the first episode, we shopped it around town and now all these networks that were not interested in it in the beginning, we're, you know, easily, we'll watch the show. Sure. Like that's, you know, mm-hmm. asking us to, you know, fund you to make a pilot is one thing, telling mm-hmm. us to sit down for 44 minutes and watch an hour episode. Great. So they did. Mm-hmm. And now all these networks wanted it.
And what changed? Why did they suddenly, what did they see in it?
Because they're not visionaries, you know, they're, you know, like I want to say like agents, you know, they're not like officially agents, but like their job is to take the ideas that people bring them and then then figure out which is the best. You know, right. they're not visionaries. I can't describe a show to them. If I describe a show to them, they're going to picture it in their way. And maybe the way they picture it, a drinking show, I don't know. It sounds like it could get a little, you know, scary if you're drinking and da-da-da-da, whatever. And so it's an easy pass for them, I guess, even though we have a big fan base
and where did you shoot a good track this, record. But where did you shoot the 6 episode in and around Los Angeles? What was
– No, we went to Kuala Lumpur, Malaysia. Mm-hmm. We went to Sydney, mm-hmm. Fiji, mm-hmm. Rome, Vienna, and Budapest.
So and you were able to do that on a $600,000 budget?
Ah, see that's someone who understands the business of because if I brought that up at a cocktail party in Syracuse, they'd be like, "Hey, how much do you have left over?" You know. As it was, for anyone who thinks they're going to throw a Kickstarter, and I find this interesting, Kickstarter takes 5%.
It's even less about that. I like to talk to people about process on my show, and I think people are intrigued by behind the scenes of how this stuff comes about. And this is you're very entrepreneurial, which I want to get to in a second. And this is a perfect story about that. And I think inspirational, not to get too schmaltzy, but like in a lot of ways, there might be somebody out there that is thinking about starting their own computer company out of their garage. You know what I mean? Like it's all relatable to people. But anyway, I interrupted you. You're going all over the world on a $600,000 budget. How does that happen?
Well, I want to just say, like, the Kickstarter takes 5%, then 5% to credit card fees. So then you're ending up about $530,000 or something like that, right? Mm-hmm. And then our rewards and the shipping of our rewards, which are T-shirts, hoodies, posters, medallions, plus I threw parties in, if you hit a certain level, you had a party in L.A., New York, and Chicago, which were like fantastic parties and dinner and all this kind of stuff. The rewards cost $170,000. Mm. So that's where we are already for the whole rewards. And then your 590 turns into like, you know, we ended up at about 300 when it was all said and done. Mm-hmm. And then I had to put in probably the same amount of my own money. Mm-hmm. In order to get the show made, but it was like, it's all or nothing. This is my one shot to make this show. And I didn't, you know, for me going in and taking out my, you know, my 401ks or whatever, just like, this is my one shot. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. To get back in the game and prove to people that this is a genre that people will watch this show and this could be successful. So when we went around and shopped it around, they didn't have to use their imagination. You took a successful Kickstarter campaign and an episode in Kuala Lumpur, you know, and a guy that's made shows like this in the past, and like, okay, this I'll watch, fine. Mm. And so at the end, Discovery Channel, Esquire, and Nat Geo were the ones that were the most interested at the end. And but at the end of the day, National Geographic Channel was the most excited about it. And mm-hmm. had a plan for it. We're gonna roll it out here. We have a mini series called Eat the Story of Food. Mm-hmm. We have a half hour show called Eric Greenspan is Hungry. Mm-hmm. We're gonna put you right in the same hour block as him. So it goes him, then you. He's eating, mm-hmm. you're drinking, whatever. And I was like, done. Like, yeah. I love it. Let's do it. So, you know, and that was, and again, that's a licensing thing fee. It's not a sale. You know, and you're not selling the episode. So it's
so
not
you-
like.
So you own them, yeah. And how did you, like, when you're going to, you're hiring local crews in those cities, and you can't be taking your crews on planes and all of that.
Yeah, we had two camera guys, a producer, a sound guy, and then you hire a local, what's called a fixer, who's like a location scout, an you know, on-the-ground producer and a translator that is working for you, you know, several weeks before you land, so that when you land, it's like, boom, here's a schedule, go here, go here, go here. Everyone's been sort of vetted. You don't want to go into a location and have them be like, wait, what are we doing? You know, whatever. You want to make sure that they're there, that either the restaurant or bar is closed or open, whichever one makes sense for what you're trying to get accomplished.
And were you traveling on trains in these cities? Like, is that because that's the idea behind it? Or were you just going to, you are? So
yeah, no. So we, like, you know, for example, Rome, fly into Rome. Mm-hmm. And then shoot some stuff in the city,
And then the next morning, we took a train to the beach, and then shot a scene there. Took a train back the next, and then shot another scene when we got back. The next day, we took a train.
And you're shooting on the trains, right?
Well, no, it's just a transition, you know. It's like, hey, I took a train to here. I took a train to here.
Yeah.
And so I took a train to a village and then ended the show outside of the city. So yeah, there's definitely a train trip in every episode. That's cool. It's the through line of justifying the. Yeah.
And also the idea of, you know, to get Mark Cuban interested, you like essentially did a showcase, and he was at that showcase where you sort of essentially kind of were peddling your wares back in 2006 or 2009?
Yeah, so that was, so Three Sheets went off the air when the network closed down. I held a Save Three Sheets campaign where we marched through LA and New York. Mm-hmm. And we had 700 people in LA. We went to three different bars. It was a mob. And then in New York, we had like over 1,000 people. We couldn't even fit into the bars that we had scheduled to go to. And then we were on the street. The cops are like, you know, dude, you can't do this. Like, this is unlawful assembly. And like, this isn't just a few people down a pub crawl. And, you know, whatever. One of the guys knew the show, one of the cops. So like we were fine. And then at the last location, I was upstairs and my buddy comes up. He's like, hey, Mark Cuban's downstairs. He wants to talk to you. I'm like, Mark Cuban's not downstairs. He doesn't want to talk to me, but I'll go downstairs with you just to prove to you that it's not Mark Cuban. And I go downstairs and I'm like, oh, hey, Mark, he's Zane. I want the show. Let's talk, you know, whatever. And I'm like, geez, this is unexpected, you know?
You had no dealings with him before this, or you had?
No. He was just, he heard about our Save Three Sheets crawl, and he flew in and joined us on it. And I didn't know he was on it because there was 1,000 other people. I didn't know he was on it until the very end.
How did he hear about it? Is he just from
social media? You know, he's big on social media.
Yeah.
And so he said, I want to buy the show. I'm like, well, Three Sheets wasn't really mine to sell, you know, but I'll put you in touch with the people, you know, whatever. And they wanted too much money. And so he passed on it. And then when that whole thing was done, I called him up and like, you know, let's do it. He's like, yeah, let's do it. I love it. And I was dealing with him before he was doing Shark Tank, you know, and he was cool. You know, he's kind of a mentor in ways. And I've gone out drinking with him several times, and he's a normal guy. Just a
That's
normal
a great
guy.
That story. Can, That's like, a great buy, story. Well, people need to check out the show November 24th, 10:30 p.m. Pacific time, 9:30 Central time, and I assume 7:30 East Coast time. Chug.
No, it's 10:30 East and West, and then it's not.
Oh, 10:30. It's 10:30 East and West. Okay, sorry. Yeah. 10:30 East and West, 9:30 Central, and the podcast, the Zane Lamprey Show. I had a great time on it. Definitely check that out. And follow you on Facebook and Twitter. And I'm going to be coming to LA again in, I don't know, in the next month. So we got to get together and have a few drinks or no drinks. It's up to you since you're
drinking. We are going to have 22 16-ounce drinks, my friend. I want to see what happens.
And then you're going to put my junk back in my pants after
that. That's right. That's right.
Hey, this is great, man. I'm so glad that it's worked out for somebody who's like really good and entrepreneurial, and doesn't take no for an answer. I think it's an awesome story. So
I appreciate that. Thank you.
Yeah, man. Absolutely. And always fun hanging out and shooting the shit with you. So check out the show. Check out his show on Nat Geo and check out his podcast for sure. Zane Lamprey, people.
Cheers, brother. Thank you.
All right, that was Zane Lamprey, great guy. I love his story, like how he wouldn't take no for an answer and went out and got some money and generated his own episodes and sold it. So there's a lesson in that, which is you should call Zane Lamprey and help him get you money for your project. Anyway, check me out doing stand-up. Come out, hang out. We've been having a great time on the road. I was in Austin, Texas, blew it out there. Had a great time at the Foxwoods Casino last week. This week, I'm going to be at the Omaha Funny Bone, and I'm going to go see a University of Nebraska game, too. I'm very psyched with my friend Larry the Cable Guy. But come see me November 20th to the 23rd at the Omaha Funny Bone, December 3rd through the 7th at the Columbus Funny Bone in Columbus, Ohio. December 11th to the 15th, I'm going to be at the Improv in Denver. And December 18th to the 21st, the DC Improv. And keep getting the word out about the podcast, man. I need bodies and we need more bodies. We want to blow this thing up. Thanks.
You take over one borough at a time. Secure our territory. Secure our turf. Because it's all our turf.